Back in the 70s, a pastor named Wilbur Reese wrote, "I would like to buy $3 worth of God, please. Not enough to explode my soul or disturb my sleep, but just enough to equal a cup of warm milk or a snooze in the sunshine." This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, and you're listening to the first of Wyoming Catholic College's new distance learning course, Into the Lenten Desert, Learning to Pray with the Medieval Masters, featuring Dr. Jason Baxter. While Pastor Reese was clearly caricaturing, nonetheless, there's great truth in what he says. For the most part, we want a God with whom we can feel comfortable. We want a God who we can take or leave. We want a God who is great and awful, but not too great and not too awful. Who hates sin, but not too much. Who is holy, but also nice, like a cup of warm milk or a snooze in the sunshine. That God is beyond our reckoning, beyond our understanding, beyond our imagination doesn't occur to most of us most of the time. And in the grand sweep of Christian spirituality, that makes us more than a little odd. In this first lecture, Wyoming Catholic College professor Dr. Jason Baxter introduces us to what for many is an unknown and slightly suspect world, the world of mysticism, discussing the soul from whom God hides nothing.
Over the past few years, when teaching Dante to college students, I found it necessary to give an introduction to mysticism by way of background to the final canticle, Paradiso. I've noticed, though, that as I talk about ineffability and the Platonic tradition of God beyond being, and the necessity of waking up as sense, as above reason, my students are overcome by a sense of trepidation and caution. On more than one occasion, noticing that my students had tightened up and had begun to look at me suspiciously, I've paused to ask, "Is this stuff making you nervous?" It does, because it seems to them somehow vaguely Eastern or associated with New Age spirituality. Take, for example, Meister Eckhart, the 14th century German Dominican, who along with the 6th century Byzantine Dionysius the Areopagite is often taken as the mystic's mystic. Eckhart was a celebrity professor in his day, a sometime provost at the University of Paris, and a biblical commentator who also undertook the difficult task of preaching in the vernacular, in his case German, which did not have the linguistic and propositional subtlety of Latin or Greek. His German sermons are renowned for being particularly bold, drawing on sensuous imagery to compensate for the lack of technical terminology. Eckhart also sought to speak in a way that could move a non-clerical, uneducated, and even illiterate audience. Here's what he says in one of his German language sermons. "In created things I have often said before, there is no truth, but there is something which is above the created being of the soul, which is untouched by any createdness, by any nothingness. Even the angels do not have this, whose clear being is pure and deep. It's like the divine nature. In itself, it is one and has nothing in common with anything. And it is with regard to this that many teachers go wrong. It's a strange land, a wilderness, being more nameless than with name, more unknown than known. If you could do away with yourself for a moment, even for less than a moment, then you would possess all that this possesses in itself. But as long as you have any regard for yourself in any way or for anything, then you will not know what God is. As my mouth knows what color it is and my eye what taste is, that is how little you will know what God is." These words are as frightening as they are intriguing. Eckhart says that we know as much about God as the eye knows about tasting or the tongue tells us about color, because we've been using the wrong faculty to experience him. God is above our reason, above our consciousness, and even above our morality. He dwells in a special uncreated part of the soul, and to move into that part of the soul requires doing away with yourself. It's like venturing into a nameless desert, an unknown wilderness, a strange land. I'm sympathetic with the reaction of my students and other audiences, because I know the people I speak to want to be faithful Christians and are afraid of adulterating the message of Christ. But at the same time, the more I've read, the more I've been struck by the fact that in the pre-modern age, that is what's now called late antiquity in the Middle Ages, everything you could say before 1500 AD, such so-called mysticism wasn't some bizarre, exotic, or unusual phenomenon like it has become, but rather it was the lifeblood of prayer and adoration of God and the soul. For this reason, it's too precious to stay silent on. Ignoring it would be like selling a precious family heirloom at an estate sale because you didn't know what it was. Some of my readers might be nervous about mysticism, not so much because of its association with Eastern religions, Hinduism, Buddhism, or Sufism, but because it feels to them like a Catholic or Orthodox thing, and thus assume it's not for them. George Eliot, though no Protestant, voiced this assumption in 19th century Protestant England when she characterized the quaint but enticing Mediterranean spirituality of Teresa of Avila at the beginning of her novel, Middlemarch. Similarly, I remember reading as a teenager the stern warning of the Presbyterian Benjamin Butler Warfield, whose words made me suspicious of mysticism for a decade. Quote, "The common element in all these varieties of mysticism is that they all seek the knowledge of God and human feelings, which they look upon as the sole or at least the most trustworthy or the most direct source of the knowledge of God." End quote. In light of this, Warfield adds, "We should be wary of mysticism, because Christianity ought to be founded on an external authority." Even C.S. Lewis, the correspondent to the greatest scholar of mysticism of his day, Evelyn Underhill, and whose academic background made him interested in medieval spirituality, voiced caution about indulging in it too much. In his Way of Glory sermon, for example, after soaring to some incredible heights of theological speculation, he reins himself back in and warns people about getting carried away. What would it be to taste at that fountainhead, that stream, of which even these lower reaches prove so intoxicating? He wonders. Yet that, I believe, is what lies before us. The whole man is to drink joy from the fountain of joy. As St. Augustine said, the rapture of the saved soul will flow over into the glorified body. In the light of our present specialized and depraved appetites, we cannot imagine this torrens voluptatis. And I warn everyone seriously not to try. And finally, we can add that at the beginning of the 20th century, the massively influential Protestant theologian Adolf von Harnack worried about Hellenic interpolations into an original pure Christianity. If Luther distrusted Latin scholasticism, von Harnack was suspicious of the encroachment of Greek philosophy into the primitive church. And if that were the case, then we should also be on our guard against all Greek ideas, which form the backbone of the medieval Christian articulation of mysticism. I know I'll not be able to convince all of my listeners that mysticism is a fundamental part of Christianity, irrespective of whether you're Protestant or Orthodox or Catholic. But I would like to make it easier on some of my listeners to be patient with it, to listen to it, to give credence to it. And so, in this course, I'll focus on writings before the Protestant counter-reformations. Writings after that, I think, often feel the pressure to reject things because they're Catholic, or double down on things because they're not Protestant. And although the occasional reference to post-Reformation figures to illustrate memorably some particular point is unavoidable, I want to focus on a time when Christianity was, nominally at least, united. Even when I get to those writings after the Great Schism, between East and West, sometime around 1054, I think we'll be able to see that even here, these authors were still drawing from a shared store. It is true, though, that without the Greek philosophical tradition, particularly the Platonic tradition, as I'll discuss later on in this course, we would not have the text that I will be discussing. Without Plotinus, there would be no Augustinian flight of the soul, as described in Confession 7 and 9 and 10. Without Proclus, there would be no Dionysius the Areopagite. And without Dionysius and Augustine, there would be no Eckhart or Cusanus. The Platonic tradition in particular provided early Christians with that terminology, methodology, and systematic impulse to describe and classify. In other words, to build out the skeleton of what has come to be known as mystical theology. And this goes straight to the heart of the paradox of Western mysticism. Although they are concerned with an experience of God, which is beyond language and beyond rationality, Almost every mystical treatise is concerned with demarcating the steps, grading the stages, outlining the method of preparation, and describing the overall system in which such experiences play out. Medieval authors love artificial schema and visual aids to help them keep it all together. Steps on a ladder, wings on a seraphim, rooms in an ark, chambers in a castle, etc. Perhaps pre-modern writers of mysticism are so cautious, so concerned with classifying those steps and describing the preliminary preparation, because it's so easy to confuse some subjective emotional high or sincere desire to be deep with the experience of depth itself. In any case, this is the biggest surprise, I think, for modern readers. If you're mainly accustomed to reading modern spiritual authors who like to anthologize and talk only about the most sublime and rapturous moments from ancient texts, then when you turn to the old authors themselves, you'll be surprised by how much space is devoted to non-mystical stuff. The paradox, then, is that mystical writers spend a massive amount of time talking about the rational intellect, or virtue, or pious practices. And if you come with the wrong expectations, then you'll be disappointed when you find that about 89% of these treatises are not about the good stuff, the sublime encounter with God. This emphasis on the rational and foundational elements is, I believe, ultimately the inheritance of the Greek and Roman philosophical tradition. But all this does not mean that mysticism is a Greek thing, pure and simple. If mysticism is, at its core, driven by the desire to be a man from whom God hides nothing, to paraphrase a medieval description of Meister Eckhart, that is, to know the fullness of God in the depths of my soul, then we find it anticipated already everywhere within the scriptures. For example, when God called out to Moses from the burning bush, "Moses, Moses, draw not nigh hither, put off thy shoes from off thy feet." Moses, understandably, quote, hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. Later, on Sinai, the Lord tells Moses that it is a terrible thing that I will do with thee. And when the Lord has descended in the cloud, Moses, again overcome by the awe-filled presence of God, quote, made haste and bowed his head toward the earth and worshiped. Later, Isaiah saw the Lord sitting upon a throne high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple, surrounded by seraphim who were shouting, while the post of the door moved at the voice of him that cried, and the house was filled with smoke. Isaiah, too, is terrified. Then said I, "Woe is me, for I am undone, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." Poor Ezekiel, when the word of the Lord came expressly unto him, beheld a vision of a whirlwind out of the north, a great cloud, and a fire enfolding itself, and a brightness was about it, and all kinds of phantasmagorical wheels and creatures and gems. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And when I saw it, I fell upon my face. Abraham has a deep sleep fall upon him, and lo, a horror of great darkness fell upon him. He later entertains angels, while Jacob has his thigh put out of joint by an angel, and is given a vision of a ladder with angels descending and ascending. When Jacob wakes up from his vision of the ladder, he finds himself in a cold sweat. And Jacob awaked out of his sleep, and he said, "Truly the Lord is in this place, and I knew it not." And he was afraid, and said, "How dreadful is this place? This is none other than but the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven." In scriptural encounters with God, then, the human beholders are inevitably stupefied, overwhelmed, fallen down, overawed by how much the divine beauty, power, or glory exceeds previous expectations. In the New Testament, the same pattern continues. The disciples briefly see Christ transparent in his glory, and as Jesus prayed, the fashion of his countenance was altered and his raiment was white and glistening. As you might expect by this point, the disciples with Jesus fell on their face and were sore afraid. Meanwhile, Peter babbles nonsense. Paul, who suddenly found himself enveloped in a bright light from heaven, accordingly fell to the earth, as John does during his vision on Patmos in Apocalypse chapter 1. And most mysteriously of all, Paul alludes autobiographically to an ecstatic rapture into heaven. Quote, "I know a man in Christ about 14 years ago, whether in body I cannot tell, that he was caught up into paradise and heard unspeakable words, which is not lawful for a man to utter. These scriptural narratives are profoundly moving, almost disturbing. The God who made the world cannot be contained within it. If you try to look at God from within this world, so to speak, you're limiting what you can see. But in select moments, the screen, this veil, this covering is ripped away or torn open, and we're left to gape inarticulately at what's behind babbling nonsense. When medieval and early Christian authors steeped in these scriptural accounts also had access to the best of paganism, an extraordinary thing happened. They tried to frame out the wild and disorienting narratives of scripture and develop them in those articulate, bold, and precise terms they found in their beloved pagan authors. A writer like Gregory of Nyssa used his Greek learning to map out a path in which we ordinary Christians can presume to lead a life like Moses. Similarly, Augustine confesses that he longs to see God's face, echoing a sentiment drawn from the life of Moses. In the meantime, the writer known as Pseudo-Dionysius the Areopagite, more on him later, adopted the literary persona of being Paul's disciple. Schooled in the most sophisticated Athenian Platonism of his day, he claimed that his writings were meant to explicate that vision that Paul cryptically hinted at in 2 Corinthians. The combination of these two traditions, then, the Greek and the scriptural, created a desire and a strategy to be a man from whom God hides nothing. In other words, mysticism. We're now all ready to take a shot at the first question. What is mysticism? Maybe it's better to start with what mysticism is not. It's not necessarily about voices or visions. It's not a whimsical or capricious shakerism in which you're violently seized with a personal revelation. Rather, it's the fruit of love and virtue and patience and diligence and prayer and discipleship. Mysticism is about God, beauty, prayer, and the depth of the soul. Through a careful practice of discipline and character and training of the mind, it aims to achieve an intellectual vision, that is, to achieve unmediated contact with God. But this intellectual vision is hard to win. Technically, you can't win it. It's a gift. But nevertheless, to get at this point of intellectual vision, at the highest point of your soul, as Augustine puts it, you have to pass through prior stages of purgation of the heart and purgation of the mind, until the practice of charity, including intellectual charity, becomes natural. In this way, mysticism is a rational, ethical, and systematic preparation for an experience of the fullness of God. But there's more. Mysticism is founded on the belief that every soul is made with infinite desire, which only an infinite bliss can satisfy. Mysticism believes that this infinite fountain for which our souls thirst is God, and God cannot be contained within the creation he made. Nor can he be comprehended fully within human language and rationality, which represents that creation in our minds. And thus, mysticism is an ascent through rationality toward the edge of language. And when we have arrived at the periphery of language, we walk over the edge and fall into the darkness of unknowing, as Dionysius calls it, which is not an ignorance, but a way of knowing that is higher and deeper than my customary rational consciousness. In other words, it is a learned ignorance, as Nicholas of Cusa called it. This darkness of unknowing is a moment of deep connection, of union, of closeness, of presence. The way I like to put it is this. Mysticism is founded on the desire to experience God in his fullness in the depths of my soul. It is the Mosaic desire to see God face to face and unveiled, or, as one Cistercian writer put it, it's the real meaning behind Psalm 42:7. Deep calleth unto deep. At the noise of thy waterspouts, all thy waves and thy billows are gone over me. In this way, mysticism is marked by a kind of holy presumptuousness, in which I, an ordinary Christian, conceive the audacious desire to demand to see the face of God uncovered. The mystic wants to speak to the Lord face to face as a man speaketh unto his friend. The mystic wants to see the Lord sitting upon a throne high and lifted up, as Isaiah did. The mystic wants to see the veil of temporal reality ripped in order to get a glimpse of the fullness of reality that lies behind it, as Ezekiel or John did. The mystic is bold enough to desire to be the friend of God, like Abraham was called. The mystic believes, along with C.S. Lewis, that in the end, there are no ordinary people. The mystical soul boldly refuses to accept that great encounters with God were the exclusive privilege of biblical heroes. But at the same time, moved within by this holy presumption, the mystic realizes that to reach this pinnacle in which the maker of the world, unveiled, addresses me, I must pass through a period of discipleship, discipline, and even abnegation. I have to develop a taste for eternal things, and I have to break addictive cravings for temporal things. And then I even have to move beyond my own morality, realizing that being good is not good enough. And finally, I even have to move beyond my expectation that I can know God. Because God is the maker of the heaven and earth, the world of being, he does not dwell within it. And thus my language and reasoning are inadequate to know him. I have to develop a deeper power of knowing, that is, to open the inner eye or interior vision, or as the ancient philosopher Plotinus put it, turn within and wake up a way of knowing. And so when I come to the pinnacle of my soul, I have to step out into darkness, leaving behind my reason. And because this is frightening, it takes epic ambition, or as one scholar put it, an extraordinary treasure of intellectual generosity. This daring quest, this soaring ascent up to God, leads us into unnameable parts of the soul, which paradoxically are deeper down within me than I am to myself. And so we have a paradoxical juxtaposition of inwardness and upwardness, a quest which leads me to the core of my personality by way of leading me to the highest point of reality. Because the mystical quest ventures out into a space beyond language and knowing, there's an important poetic aspect within the mystical tradition. Indeed, medieval authors frolic in a rich field of metaphors, gathering as many likenesses as they can, all of which, at best, though, merely gesture and point to that which is ultimately unsayable. And so, already, even in these last few paragraphs, I've been speaking of the barren desert and retreating into the inner castle of interiority, soaring and flying up, of deep calling to deep and a cloud of unknowing. Since God's beyond language, the mystical writer has to stretch his language, find elaborate and exuberant metaphors for hinting at what is above it. And so in this course, we'll hear about the nudity of the soul, of falling into a chasm, of plunging into an ocean, of the opening up of an abyss, and most incredibly of all, the hurricane of God's love. In short, all of this bold language, which burns like fire and cuts like swords, is based on the conviction that this is on the periphery of language. God is fuller, bigger, brighter than I can imagine, than I have ever previously expected. But to see or taste God, we need to guard ourselves from the tendency to turn God into an idol, to think of him as something small or limited, some kind of cosmic agent who exists in order to help me be good or get things I want. Mysticism is setting aside all of these idols of the imagination and cravings of the will, a resolute purpose to let God be God, and a bold entry into the cloud of unknowing. In the end, mysticism is when God hides nothing from the soul.
While Dr. Baxter addressed the question of why we need mystics, he left open the question of why we need the medieval masters in particular. Why go back centuries to learn? Be with us next week as Dr. Baxter continues with a lecture entitled, How Did We Get Here? Why We Need the Medieval Masters.